Hello, and welcome to today's episode of the ABCs, Authors Between the Covers. What makes successful authors tick? What does it take to sell that manuscript? Is self-publishing a good option? Or is selling your book to a big publishing house still the only way to fly? What about keeping up with your first big success? We'll talk about all this and more on today's show, hosted by journalist and publisher Hope Katz Gibbs, author of Truly Amazing Women Who Are Changing the World and PR Rules, The Playbook. Every month, 5 million people move from the past to the future, writes Daniel Brook, author of the 2013 book, A History of Future Cities. He says, quote unquote, pouring into developing world instant cities like Dubai and Shenzhen, these urban newcomers confront a modern world cobbled together from fragments of a West they have never seen. He asks, do these fantastical boom towns, where blueprints spring to life overnight on virgin land, represent the dawning of a brave new world? Or is their vaunted newness a mirage? These are fascinating questions, and we were thrilled to have Daniel Brook here with us on Authors Between the Covers. Hello, Daniel.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Just as we were starting, I told you that the future of cities is the theme for our May 2015 issue of Be Incandescent magazine. And when I went looking for a book of the month, yours popped up, and it couldn't be a more perfect fit. So tell us, first and foremost, what does it mean, the history of future cities? Where'd you come up with this concept?
The title is, I think, very clever. My editor finally pinned the title on the book, so he gets credit. But it's incredibly appropriate. I'm looking in the book at the future of the global city, the city that brings in people from all over the world, where new ideas arise. New art forms, new corporate structures, new governmental structures, new transit systems, transportation systems, and where they have antecedents in the past. So rather than just look at the 21st century as a kind of blank slate, I looked at little snippets of the past, specific times and places where this type of breakneck globalized city development took place in the past. And I identified three global cities that fit the bill. St. Petersburg, Russia, which is a city that's younger than New York, Boston, or Philadelphia. It was founded in 1703, and within a few decades became one of Europe's most dynamic cities. Then Shanghai and Bombay, now Mumbai. Shanghai experiencing tremendous growth after it was wrested from the Chinese Empire by imperial powers in 1842, turned that into a kind of Western-looking city in the East, and Bombay, which experienced tremendous growth actually during the American Civil War, when the port of New Orleans, where I'm doing this interview from, was blockaded, and the cotton could not get out. So the second best source of cotton for the global market was India. And Bombay just exploded in the 1860s, became a major global city. And now again today, is as with Shanghai, sort of re-engaging with the world and experiencing this type of growth. So in order to understand the type of growth that's happening in today's Mumbai and Shanghai, but also today's Bangalore and Shenzhen, Sao Paulo or Nairobi, or the list goes on, the best way is to look to the past. So A History of Future Cities. It's a clever title that gets at the fact that the cities of the future have these fascinating antecedents all over the world, and I've traced the history of several of them.
And it is. It's so interesting, and obviously it's a great hook. And just to tell the audience, Daniel is a very successful journalist. His work has appeared in Harper's, The Nation, Foreign Policy, and Slate. And you actually traveled to these cities to report about them for the book. You say your goal is to watch them in their dress rehearsal for the 21st century. What exactly do you mean by that, and what was it like to live in these cities in the present?
Sure. The concept of a dress rehearsal for the 21st century is for the past portions of the book. The idea that what was going on in St. Petersburg in the 1700s, where the Tsar, through his absolute authority, erected a fascinatingly perfectly modern city overnight and invited in the greatest minds of Western Europe to kind of staff it is very much like what's going on, say, in Dubai, where the Sheikh has sort of willed this megacity into being and brought in skilled foreigners from the West to kind of run the machine. But actually spending time in the cities, I was doing two things, living in each of them for a month. A, sort of uncovering their past, which in Petersburg, Mumbai, and Shanghai is not as difficult as it sounds, in that so much of the historic fabric of those cities is intact through a mix of sort of overt architectural preservation with policies, but also through the sort of rough, neglectful 20th century that all of those cities experienced, where very little was getting built, and a lot of buildings were preserved simply because there were no developers knocking them down to put up bigger, better versions. And then I was also, in addition to sort of experiencing these historic environments as best as one can in the modern world, I was also looking at how these cities are dealing with globalization today, and I was meeting with architects and urban planners and business people and journalists and the people who are making the cities run today. So the book ultimately sort of begins in the past, but moves into the present and is very much engaged with these cities as global business hubs today, as well as in what we can learn about sort of the nature of the global city from the past of the more historic cities.
It sounds like you had a whole lot of fun. I would have liked to have been a fly on the wall or just sitting next to you at the table. But you suggest that understanding today's emerging global order requires comprehending the West's profound and conflicted influence on developing world cities over the centuries. Talk a little bit about that. Why is it so important that we understand the past to see where we're going?
In the historic cities that I'm writing about, sort of conflation of westernization with modernization is very overt in ways that it sort of wouldn't or couldn't be today. It would sort of be politically incorrect, and it would also sort of undermine the authorities' authority with their people. You know, when Peter the Great was, you know, creating the Russian Academy of Sciences in St. Petersburg, he staffed it entirely with non-Russians. When Muhammad today in Dubai starts the Dubai School of Government, you know, he invites Harvard in as a consultant to model it on the Kennedy School of Government. But the idea that there would be no Arabs on the faculty would be completely inconceivable. The goal there is to sort of mix some locals with foreign experts. At the same time, the link between the West and modernity has not been totally severed as of yet. It certainly may be in this century. So that as, you know, place like, you know, Bangalore modernizes, you know, Silicon Valley is like a very prominent and obvious model for development of the city of Bangalore, which is India's tech center. And this is always going to create a certain anxiety within the population, and it can be either within individual people who are kind of concerned about losing touch with the culture of their ancestors, or more importantly, I think, between these cities that are kind of rushing into globalization and the rural areas of these countries that are left behind. So again, this idea of the tensions that westernization can create are problematic. At the same time, going forward in the century, you have more and more non-Western places sort of pioneering modernity. In the past, for example, the British brought the train to Mumbai. That's the first railway in Asia. Today, of course, you know, the fastest trains in the world are from Asia and have to be exported to the West. So I suspect we're going to see more and more of that, and the simple conflation of the West with the modern world is going to dissipate.
Yeah, it's fascinating just taking a look at, and this is, I mentioned earlier to you that Future in Focus is a futurist think tank that's one of our clients, and they do a great job about taking a look at the world from consumer and business point of view and tracking trends just as you are.
Yeah, well, that's a fascinating aspect of this. I mean, the whole phenomenon of K-pop, I think, is really fascinating, that really for decades since the birth of rock and roll in the U.S. and U.K., so much of the popular music culture went from the US and UK to the rest of the world. And now that's really changing. I mean, we've seen Korean popular culture is kind of sweeping the world. And I think that's just, you know, first of many cultural trends that are going to emerge out of what we call the developing world, but it's almost a misnomer if those are the countries that are setting the trends.
So what else are you seeing in some of the cities that you talked about?
So the culture of Bollywood is sort of more widespread than we in America realize. I mean, that film industry has reached into, you know, the former Soviet Union, certainly all over South Asia and the Middle East. And that may be, you know, that may be coming our way as well. In a place like Dubai, you do see an effort to sort of pioneer, sort of master plan a city of the future more than in the past. I mean, initially it was very derivative. The planning in Dubai was very derivative of the West. They brought in planners mostly from the UK who put these kind of roundabouts everywhere, and then they got into the sort of Houston model, and they literally built what I believe holds the Guinness Book of World Records for the widest expressway in the world, with like something like 20-something lanes in each direction. Actually, the military government of Myanmar built something similar for about a mile, just to get the record, but it's the widest usable expressway, functional expressway in the world. But now with these sort of driverless metro trains that are springing up in Dubai and air-conditioned bus shelters and all of these things, you see Dubai sort of taking lead in public transportation technology and things that really could and should be exported. I certainly wish New Orleans had some air-conditioned bus shelters. We could use them.
Yeah, and that's a question that I have. How do you see what you've experienced around the world in these burgeoning cities that have such historic pasts, that it's applied here or not? And do you think it will be in the future, or do you think that America is kind of so locked down in our own ways that we won't accept other cultures, you know, what they're teaching us and what they're experiencing?
I mean, I think in the same way that the same types of tensions I see in the countries I'm writing about, I see in the U.S. between city and between sort of the metropolitan America and rural America, but also between the kind of globalizing early adopter cities and the more laggard cities. There are places in America that are as open to experimentation in urban form as almost anywhere in the world. I mean, within the parameters of our sort of democratic governance structure. I mean, there are cities that are looking at, you know, adopting best practices from all over the world. And then there are other places that are more set in their ways.
Which cities do you think are on the forefront?
I mean, you know, city like Seattle, you know, is a progressive place. New York is maybe more, someone originally from New York, maybe more open to experimentation than it really should be, sometimes not fully thinking through the implications of all of its experimentation, but there's plenty of, you know, with the sort of recreation of Broadway as a pedestrian cycling sort of urban plaza, is very innovative. You have these streetcar programs going on in many cities. I mean, some sort of better than others. And you have new development, you know, something like Mission Bay in San Francisco, which, you know, I have mixed feelings about, but it is the kind of large-scale urban planning that we had kind of convinced ourselves we couldn't do, and, you know, they did it. So there are plenty of, you know, there's also plenty of in smaller cities as well. It's really a case-by-case basis, but the idea that the U.S. is sort of hopelessly behind, I don't buy into. I think that could be a self-fulfilling prophecy. The places that sort of want to learn from the rest of the world are actively learning from the rest of the world. And I think that's the hope for all of us.
That's excellent and very hopeful. My question is, what do you think it is about all these cities that you've observed that makes some of them change agents and open to ideas and others not?
I think as far as I can tell, you know, from the research I've done and the writing I've done, you want to have a kind of balance and equilibrium, both sort of goes for the human being, the human individual, the human sort of smaller communities, say the family, the neighborhood, and then the city as a whole, between the sort of comforts of the old and the progress of the new. And when these things get too out of whack, it's not helpful for the individual or for the city. So I think the idea is to sort of balance an openness without a feeling of being completely unmoored. And sometimes the places that grab the headlines for being the most sort of leaping into the future sort of crash and burn the fastest and the hardest, because they get too disconnected from their roots. Certainly, I'm not sort of predicting the collapse of Dubai, but speaking to locals in Dubai who, you know, born and bred in Dubai and have lived there for their whole lives, there's a real sense of disorientation and resentment about what this city has become and how unrecognizable it is to them, their own hometown. At the same time, when a place really locks down, it doesn't serve anyone's purposes. And the, you know, in the book, the Stalin period in St. Petersburg is a really sad and miserable chapter in the history of the city, where, you know, everything is locked down, and the city gets so far away from its cosmopolitan roots that, I mean, literally meeting with a foreigner, you know, will get you interrogated by the KGB. Any piece of mail that comes in from abroad will be checked and read. And I don't, you know, I don't think anyone, hopefully, would want to go down that route ever again, but that's certainly not a model that's going to be successful.
Right. That makes perfect sense. Obviously, human nature, growth possibilities. I'm actually in Richmond. I just opened an office here, and I have one in D.C. And I see, you know, I came to Richmond because it was so unique and novel and chill. And but you see this tension between the future and the past, old Richmond, old Southern belief systems, and kind of this artsy, funky, progressive approach. So it'll be interesting to see. I think the future is very bright for cities like Richmond and Chattanooga and wherever else there's kind of creative, artful people, artistic people, versus and that the old guard kind of understands it and accepts it. So I agree with you 100%. So tell us a little bit more about you. As I said, you're a journalist. Your articles have appeared in a million magazines, including the New York Times and so many others. You're also the author of The Trap, Selling Out to Stay Afloat in Winner Take All America, which I think we should actually do another article on. And your architectural writing won the 2010 Winter House Award for Design, Writing, and Criticism. So that's pretty amazing. What inspired you to write a history of future cities?
My work is pretty unified in that I'm interested in how ideas are implemented in the real world. I mean, that's really what draws me to architecture. Designing a building, you know, it's not the same as making a sculpture or painting a painting. I mean, it has to function in the world. At the same time, it's an idea that's sprung from somebody's head, and often informed by how they would like, you know, people to interact with the world. So I've been drawn to architecture and city planning sort of through that mode. And then The Trap, also, much of The Trap, which I would encourage you to read, is about sort of hyper-gentrification in places like Manhattan or San Francisco, and how that squeezes out culture and also, you know, sort of limits who can live in these places, and the types of jobs they can do and the types of options they have to, you know, quit your job and start your own company or work in the public sector or et cetera, et cetera. So again, it's sort of that. It gets back to economic policy and how sort of the country's political turn since the 1980s, and how that sort of plays out on the ground in our largest cities. Finally, you know, I also write, you know, book reviews of nonfiction, and there again, that's almost like a book. It's almost like a building in that you're taking an idea that's in some kind of inchoate form in your head and then trying to build it in a way that it will stand up. So, yes, so I think that sort of nonfiction writing, you know, book reviewing and criticism can also get at these same questions of how ideas are built or implemented. So that's that's what I've been working on. I'm currently working on a history book about the American South, and I'm also working on a global reporting project on urbanization in the developing world that will continue some of the themes I've worked on in History of Future Cities, but sort of purposefully in different places, not Bombay and Shanghai, but some sort of smaller, quirkier places that I think don't get enough attention because they're small and quirky, but I think are fascinating also because they're small and quirky.
Very good. You say in the book a couple of things that I really enjoy. First, that you thought that you wanted this to be for a general audience, but it's actually such a high-level thinking book that it's really for people that are studying this topic, academics almost, and educators. How has that played out for you in terms of book sales?
I mean, I wanted it to be a book that anyone with an interest in these topics could pick up and get through. Which I think it is, but I also did not want to sort of dumb it down to the degree that, you know, would like necessarily maximize the audience. I mean, sales have been adequate. I wish they were, you know, blockbuster. I'm hoping that the book will, I mean, it has been, but I'm hoping it will be adopted as a course book for undergraduate courses in, you know, urban sociology, urban political science, urban history, because I think that's the level, the audience I want to reach, which is sort of the interested non-expert.
Yeah, and you accomplished that for sure. I mean, this isn't something you want to pick up in or that you'd pick up and read on the beach necessarily, unless it's really a passion of yours, but it's really well done. It's very articulate, incredibly well written. Very thoughtful, fascinating history. I thought you did a beautiful job. But also, you know, to touch the heart, you say at the end of the book that you dedicate the book to your parents. You say this sort of in the last page, and that they took you to St. Petersburg when you were a kid, and that changed your life. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, I was 12 years old, and we went with family friends to Moscow and St. Petersburg. We actually have a very small and shrinking branch of the family in Moscow. We were all descended from actually somebody from St. Petersburg, my great uncle or great great uncle, something along those lines. And I'd never, I think they'd been to Puerto Rico or, you know, it was like far and away the most exotic place I'd ever been in my life. And I remember being just struck by the beauty of the place, that the idea that, I mean, growing up in the New York area, the idea that a city could really be beautiful was not in my frame of reference. I mean, I would say New York's ugly, but I would say like the adjectives to describe New York are, you know, powerful or majestic or, you know, even the good adjectives. I don't think beautiful would be one you would use very often unless it was on a perfectly still night with the skyline glistening. Certainly not with the sun out. You would never use beautiful. So that was striking. But also the tour guide who was taking us around kept talking about how it was, you know, built as a Western city, and, you know, at age 12, you don't have a particularly good notion of what that means, but it was, and I'd never been to Western Europe. You know, this is supposed to look like France, and this is supposed to look like Holland, and she started explaining all this, and I'd never been to any of those places. But I was intrigued by it, so the story of St. Petersburg, where the book starts, which is really just an amazing story. I mean, when you almost, unless it were so well documented, you wouldn't even believe that the Tsar of Russia secretly travels to Holland and, you know, comes back and demands that they build him in Amsterdam. I mean, this is, sounds like a myth, but it's all true. It's all documented. So that's where the book starts. And, you know, going from being 12 to being in my 30s, which is what I am now and the age that I wrote the book, you know, you're able to explore all these things more fully and with a broader perspective.
Perspective, I think that's the word that sums up this amazing book, A History of Future Cities. You're giving us a great dive into the past and a look into the future. Thank you, Daniel Brook, for your time and this wonderful book that you've given us.
Thank you, Hope. I'm really thrilled to bring it to your audience.
Thank you. Well, we're talking to Daniel Brook on Authors Between the Covers on the Incandescent Radio Network, The Voice of Entrepreneurs. You can read a little more about Daniel's book in the May 2015 issue of Be Incandescent Magazine, where the theme is The Cities of the Future. So look for Daniel's work in the magazine and online. Daniel, tell us how we can get your book and get to your website.
Sure. My website is daniel-brook.com. That's Brook, no E, no S. People love to add them. And the book is available at your local bookstore, on Amazon, or any online retailer. The book is widely available.
Thank you again, Daniel, and we will talk to you all soon. This is Hope Gibbs, your host on the Incandescent Radio Network. That's it for today's episode of the ABCs, Authors Between the Covers, hosted by journalist and publisher Hope Katz Gibbs, author of Truly Amazing Women Who Are Changing the World and PR Rules, The Playbook. Be sure to check back next week on the Incandescent Radio Network for another interview with a successful author who is happy to share their story. Here's to writing your heart out and keeping your dreams alive. Thanks so much for listening.